put two and two together. I just thought, well, maybe it's just because I'm running a lot and I need more calories. So I just turned the food pyramid upside down immediately in 2012, meaning, all sugars, grains, flours, pastas, pastries. Now it was eggs, meats, and vegetables.
You're listening to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, and this is Trail Talk, where we have casual conversations with all kinds of runners. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultra runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation will go. So if you're ready, let's get started. Welcome to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. I'm excited for my guest today, Dr. Mark, and I need to ask your pronunciation.
How do you, Cucuzella.
Cucuzella. Okay.
Ahead, give it a go.
Okay. Cucuzella. That was what I was going to say, but he is an ultra runner. Has just recently finished the Rim to River 100-mile trail race. He's an author of the book called Run for Your Life and professor at West Virginia School of Medicine. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Oh gosh, Eric, it's a pleasure to be here. And it was nice chatting with you a little before we got on the air.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't call myself an ultra marathoner. I have finished some, but but I guess maybe because you finish, you're at least part of that tribe.
Well, and I, from my experience, when I just got started running, I completed my first, it was just over, marathon distance. So it was a 50K. And my running friend said, welcome, you're now an ultra marathon runner. So, that is the technical definition. So if you run,
unless you've run 100 milers, because this is like Trail Running Central, and all the crazies live out here. They're like, you got to do 100 miler.
And that's kind of a hot button for me, because I mean, that puts such a high standard for people. It used to be, I know road runners, if you hadn't run a marathon, you were kind of like, when are you going to step up and do that? And it's now become the 100 mile has that same thing. And I'm like, I think it puts too much pressure on people to go out and do things that, they may not want to do.
Yeah. You have to want to do it and have some reason to.
And I think probably half the people that I run with in my running group, they're like, I have no desire to do 100 miles. I'm like, don't do whatever makes you happy.
And I didn't have any desire to do a 100 miler, Eric, until this thing called COVID hit. And pretty much everything I was going to run myself or organize, I organize races. So I had a little free time and a free weekend showed up.
Okay.
You kind of get talked into it.
Yeah. So you're a racer. So usually I try to ask people, where did you start running? How did you get started in doing this?
Well, I was, for the people listening, I'm 54 now. And when I was probably, similar to your boyhood, I started running the day I could stand on 2 feet, because we used to do this thing called go outside and play
in
the yard for hours. I probably, was on the spectrum of, ADD hyperactivity, I was one of four boys and, every day was just another mayhem day, but we were just really super active kids, played a variety of sports, but I was always like the little speedy kid, little scrappy kid.
Okay.
Was on the football field or the baseball field. And then I stopped growing. I was really good at peewee football, and I'm still a peewee, but I was running back and they couldn't catch me. Mm-hmm. And then, but that sport kind of outgrew me and started running with my brother. I was in about the eighth grade, just occasionally jump in with him. He was on the high school cross country team. I had never heard of that sport, but and I started running. I just had this capacity to just run for a long time. And my dad signed me up for a half marathon. There weren't many races then, Eric. There might be one race in the spring, right? Mm-hmm. There wasn't like a 5K.
Right. And most of them were on the road, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a road half marathon. Mm-hmm. And it was one they had every year. And I signed up for that. And I ran like a 1:23:00 something, which is a pretty decent time. Yeah, it was right on kind of national record standard, even though I had no idea what any of that was, and didn't know anything about running or anything.
Right, yeah.
Had some old sneakers, and but that, that's kind of the beginning of the end as far as your pain-free running, because then you get tiered into, I went to high school, and start to become a single sport athlete, And then I think over, you know, you're in that growth phase, overuse injuries, you know, we're all, if you're just a highly active, motivated kid, you overdo it. And I kept doing that for many years. But, you know, I was so sad, like, you know, when I was in high school and I was hurt half the time, you know, looking back, I just loved move. I think I just needed it for my brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Rady describes it all in that book, Spark. You know, I think if anyone out there is a PE teacher, when I read that, I was like, that's me. I needed that for my brain.
So did you get any kind of coaching or help to avoid injuries, or was that science?
There wasn't really much science there. I had really good, you know, very caring coaches in high school, but I probably just, you know, like all of us, you know, you're a horse, right? And every time you go out, you want to run hard and fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the nature of the beast, and you know, you're growing rapidly. So yeah, I mean, I think almost everyone who runs through a high school career and went on to run in college at University of Virginia, you're just in a constant cycle of broken and recover broken and recover. That got me interested in medicine, actually, because I was broken so much. I started hanging around with sports doctors and thought that this might be a fun thing to do for a career, you know, be able to help people out of the mess I was always getting myself into, as well as half my teammates at the time.
Oh, that's good. So,
from your own mistakes.
Yeah. You know, like, so then beyond college, well, you college, then you went to med school, I would imagine.
Did you keep running then after that?
Since I did.
And that's when I think I never thought I would run marathons. You know, in college, you run on the track and cross country, and you don't think about road races in college. And then, I took a good break after, my senior year, you know, that whole summer, maybe a little bit into the fall before starting med school. And I was just kind of restless, you know, like you said, you gained weight. I just started gaining some weight. And a friend of mine was training for the Marine Corps Marathon, and he talked me into going out on some training runs. And within a few weeks, I was able to go out on like a 16-mile run.
Wow.
Yeah, just like that, right? Go out on weekend. Mm-hmm. And he said, you should just sign up. Because I wasn't intending, you know, I joined in for some runs. I wasn't intending on signing up for this race. I said, you should sign up for that race. It was like maybe a month or so away. You know, it's in October. And back then, it was a paper entry form. I don't even, I think I had to write away for it. And they mailed it to me. And there wasn't like a cap. I mean, so I sent in my $25 check and a piece of paper and line up. I don't know, maybe look, if you could probably look up 1988 Marine Corps Marathon, how many finishers, maybe 3,000 or 4,000 at that time.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay.
But I did pretty well. That I ran like a 2:34 and was in the maybe 25th place or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, that was kind of fun just being out on this long course. Cause I always kind of tiered toward endurance. You know, I think everyone on the college track team, some people are more, you know, kind of more milers. And then like cross country, we all kind of meet in the middle, but I was always more like the longer runs and endurance. I think that just whatever my muscle biopsy type is in my brain, you know, so I mean, I just like to run the distance, and that got me started. You know, I'd run 2-3 marathons a year, you know, just to keep me sane in med school. If I had something that I was kind of training for, I think it helped me do better in school. The running was just a break and help my brain absorb all that, you know, mostly useless stuff. You know, half of what we learn in med school is wrong. You know, we try to figure out what's right. No, we learn a lot of stuff and forget a lot of stuff. And quite often what we learn is not correct, but that's, we learn and we continue to learn. And I continue to learn, you know, every day.
Yeah, that's good. So, so you guys, you've been a lifelong runner then. You ran, or did you ever have a time when you were like not running, or did you take a break?
You've really been
doing it all your life.
It's my mental therapy. And I ended up that, I mean, little would you know that sub 3 hour, you know, 2:34 ish in 1988. So I went on to run 30 straight years of marathons under 3 hours, not intentionally.
Okay.
Yeah. I was given a talk somewhere, and I guess someone had looked up, you know, the marathon databases, and they said, you know, you've run a sub 3 marathon for like 26 straight years or something, 27 years. And I didn't look back and like, oh yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I said, well, I don't keep track of stuff or have, you know, it's like, I'm just too busy.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I was going for year 31, and that was that year that the Boston Marathon was just horrendously headwind and freezing rain. Uh-huh. I had a 3:04 there. That was when I think the winning time was like 2:16. It was the Japanese runner.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, oh, I blew it. Cause that was, I mean, that was, people were 10, 20 minutes slow, but uh-huh. that's fine. It took any time pressure off. That was like 3 years ago, I think. Yeah. So, I mean, last year I did the virtual Boston Marathon because it was okay. canceled.
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of races. A lot of races canceled. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I started dabbling in the ultra trail runs a little bit more.
So when did you start dabbling into the ultra distances?
Yeah, the ultra distance, because I'm 54 now. I was 40. There's a big ultra run out here called the JFK 50 miler.
Mm-hmm, I've heard of that.
It's the oldest ultra in the country, largest, you have like 1,000 people on the line.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Big race, you know, good mm-hmm. field. And it goes right by my house, basically. So again, you get kind of talked into it. You know, so I was running marathons still under 2:30 at that time. And race director is a really nice guy. And he says, you should try this 50 miler, you know, the JFK.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I was like, what the heck? Because it was late season. So it's after you'd really done anything. It's Thanksgiving, right before Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay.
So first year I lined up for that. I had no idea what an ultra was and, you know, how to hydrate or fuel or any mm-hmm, of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I was in like second place in this race at halfway.
Your marathon time.
Yeah. So I didn't understand anything about nutrition, or I'm a low carb runner now based on my own medical issues. But that time I was a carber. And I did the math. I'm like, well, I got to have at least like, you know, 4 gels an hour to keep up with the fuel use.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at a certain pace, you know, you don't really realize that you can't, even though it feels kind of easy, it felt easy compared to marathon pace, but I guess I couldn't digest, you know, at about halfway, I just stopped on the trail. And I think every gel that I'd eaten was on the side of the trail. And then I kind of soldiered on to about 38 miles and, you know, at that point, I told my family, I'm like, look, this is just a fun end of the year experiment. You know, if it's going well, I'll finish. But certainly I'm not going to hurt myself or make this a death march. So I walked off the trail at 38 miles. But then the next year, you know, as you know, from all these runner types, you know,
right.
you need your redemption. Mm-hmm. So the next year, I totally reset my strategy, you know, slow and, you know, not so much nutrition. And, you know, ended up running under 7 hours. For the race.
Oh, wow. That's a pretty good time for, yeah, that's a good time for a 50.
For 50.
Yeah.
So, you know, I figured out some of the mistakes, but you never know. Like what, I mean, 50 miles is a long way.
It is.
I jumped in a couple comrades, marathons in South Africa, you know, during this time too, which is another whole.
Oh yeah. That's
a different terrain, different experience. So you learn.
Yeah. Yeah. And the comrades is on road. If I remember, it's all on road. Yeah.
Unrelenting ups and downs on road.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard
that experience. You
know? Oh yeah. Yeah. It is. It's almost like they're Super Bowl. I mean, they have, you know, the country is just really
it's like the
turns
Boston
out for
marathon for, you know, 56, 58 miles that just people packed on this course.
Yeah.
And it's fun.
Yeah, I've heard about it. That's one of the things. If I had had time to do something, you know, like anything I wanted to, I was like, that's kind of on my list of like maybe someday, you know,
on your bucket list.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a long flight to get there.
Yeah,
and I don't know if they're going to have it this year or not. You know, they canceled it last year, but there's an up run and a down run, so just.
Yeah, I knew that. They switch every year. Sometimes it's up, sometimes it's down. I've heard. So.
Yeah, the down was more damaging. So as you can imagine, because there's like 17,000 feet of elevation change.
Oh wow, okay, I didn't realize it was that kind of elevation change.
Yeah, there's like you climb like there's about I think 6,000 feet difference start to finish.
Okay.
So that's the net difference. So that's the net up or the net down. But there's mm-hmm. a lot of up and down along the way. But the downs on that down run are just brutal, screaming downs if your quadriceps are not.
Yeah.
Friendly with you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about your book. I know you, what led you to, I mean, you were a runner. What led you to, writing a book about, it was called Run for Your Life. And I haven't had a chance to, I just kind of looked at a synopsis of it, and kind of tell me a little bit about what your book's about. So
writing a book. So the book, really maybe 20% of it's about running, but I'm a physician, so it's more about health, you know, so I wanted to approach it from, you know, a little bit of evolutionary biology. Let's understand how the body works, not just with running and movement, but with metabolism, you know, energy utilization, diet, you know, childhood, you know, what can we do, you know, for children to help start them on a path of health? Mm-hmm. You know, specific things is, you know, you and I are on the other side of 50.
Yes.
So we prevent that frailty that creeps up on everybody, you know, and some of the other aspects of running, you know, the social and community aspect, you know, being a race director and, you know, working here with nonprofits and volunteers, you know, there's something about that that I think is really important to people, you know, the group. So, you know, now it's been a difficult year. So many people feel isolated, but, you know, whether it's a virtual group you have now, or we still are doing little running groups, obviously with the right protection and distancing, but that community and that group is really important. But Eric, so many people get hurt. So, you know,
right.
I think it's a birthright to be able to run, and running shouldn't hurt you. By running, you should make yourself bulletproof, so you can go do other things without getting hurt, i.e. go ski, play basketball, go down the stairs, right?
So
it's just a means to be able to live a healthier lifestyle. But it should be, you know, laid out pretty simple. And that's what I tried to do, is just try to keep it simple.
So was that, and I know that I think you and I are both are in the Barefoot Running group in Facebook. And so where did you start looking at, I assume you're a minimalist runner, or running in that. So where did you
footwear? I think
natural footwear. Yeah,
is more the term. How much cushion is kind of related to each person, but you know, the foot's a magic, you know, appendage to walk or run. You know, I wouldn't even begin to say I understood what each of those 26 bones, 32 joints, 100 muscle tendon insertions are all doing, but it's got to work correctly in harmony and in its natural state. But when the foot works well, it's a spring, right? Running is a spring motion. And so many of us over the years have decommissioned our feet. You know, I learned the hard way, because I had my feet operated on not knowing anything in year 2000, you know, my foot looked like a shoe, you know, meaning
A lot of our feet do. Yeah.
My big toe is bent in about 40 degrees. And I didn't realize that was really a causative factor in why I was having injuries in multiple other places. I mean, everything changes when your foot hits the ground. And if your foot can't stabilize your landing and spring off the ground because the big toe is out of place, you know, you can't really run in the way you're designed to run. So that when I started rehabbing that, you know, started to understand and study the foot a little bit. And then just luckily just had some really good, you know, influencers in my life that just expertise, like Dr. Ray McClanahan designed these devices called Correct Toes, which were like toe spacers.
Yes, toe spacers. I've seen those.
They keep my toe in the right spot, you know, because I've lost some of the neural control of that foot, you know. So, and then just learning from him how the foot worked.
Right.
And just finding, you know, I love barefoot because it's just this enjoyable experience, you know. You know, not right now in February, I've been wearing shoes, but in the summertime, you know, if I'm on grass or smooth road, I much prefer to be barefoot. It's just, I mean, I can't tell anyone whether that's more serious, but it's more fun.
And
I can't run too hard, right? The foot's a regulator. It's impossible to run too hard if you're in your bare feet, because your feet will tell you something. So it really forces you to recover, you know, and run for the, you know, never outrun what you should be doing that day. Your feet will kind of act like a governor.
And I've noticed, because it was 2020 was my year. I decided I would experiment with barefoot running. And the thing that I noticed when I got, I mean, I like the natural movement. I like the fact that my feet were stronger, but of actually being barefoot for so much of the time, of the sensory feedback of the nerves, of being able to feel the ground, you know, directly through with my foot, was as much of a reward to me as the way that my foot was able to move and the movement.
Yeah, there's a whole layer to that. You know, people may call it like woo-woo science, but I think there is a lot to this earthing and grounding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go into the literature, because you know, like when you're barefoot and just how you feel, especially some prolonged time, something's different. You feel better. You know, if I have a stand up desk, if I actually have to get any real work done, you know, I have a little proprioceptive mat. It's got little spikes.
Oh, uh-huh.
I just there's something about that. Like I can work better.
I've seen those. Gives you a little stimulus.
And these insoles I have in my shoes are kind of same thing. These are from a company called Neboso. You can hard to see it, but this little insole probably has about 300 little things on it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's pretty cool. You know, just at the end of the day, you know, most people like plop in the lazy boy because their feet are just sucking, but I feel good at the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
you know, walking around in these little super thin proprioceptive insoles and a shoe, you know, like this is a zero shoe, you know, it's black. I can wear it to work, but I could put it in my pocket.
Yeah. They're very, I like the zero awesome. Shoes. Yeah. I like the zero shoes.
And that and many other brands for walking that have, you know, absolutely no cushion, right? Just your foot's right on the ground.
Yeah. And that's the thing that, when I tried to find some dress shoes, I was talking with my wife and she kept bringing me out these and I was like, well, the shape is not right. The shape is going to push my toe over it has a heel and she said, yeah. What's wrong with you? And I said, I've been
for
going
those bare. Listening, so what is natural footwear? So you can uh-huh. kind of break it down to a couple basic things. So the heel and the forefoot should be at the same level, meaning that's how we balance. You know, that mm-hmm. affects our posture. So the heel and the forefoot, right, just like your bare foot, there's not like an elevation. So whatever it is, you know, whether you have some stack height, you know, on that 100 miler, I wore shoes that had some cushion, but they were still completely flat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one was the Ultra Torin, which has quite a bit of cushion, but you've done 100 miles, right? If you're talking mm-hmm. about 100 miles on rocks, I'm not going to do that in a five finger. At least I'm not strong enough.
Yeah.
to do that.
there are people who do that, but they spend a lot of time conditioning their feet to those.
Yeah. I did a 50 miler in sandals and just the little thin sandals, but mm-hmm. I wasn't ready to do 100 yet in the sandals. And then I wore the Ultra Superior for half of that race too, just cause it's nice to mix it up. And that one's got a little bit of cushion. Wouldn't be called minimal, but a little less than the Torin. So
right.
It's just, I think the mix of that, like at a certain point, you're like, I don't want all this cushion. Give me a little less.
Right.
And then you just kind of find the sweet spot. But yeah, so it should be flat and it should be foot shaped, meaning like, look at if any of you all have a picture of your baby foot on the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or talk to your mother, you know, the foot's widest at the tip of the toes.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. So
yeah. And shoe manufacturers like don't make no, shoe no, manufacturers. They the style is not that at all. So.
And it should be lightweight.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I mean, most people hate the bricks on their feet, hikers especially.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it should be flexible, meaning it should bend where your foot is supposed to bend. So then it can complement what your foot does. So if it meets those criteria, flat, wide at the toe box, lightweight, flexible, your foot can work as it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time, you know, Eric, to strengthen that foot back up. Like if you've been in these foot coffins for 40 years,
mm-hmm.
I
know a lot of runners will, you know, if they've had a pretty high heel, or what they call the stack height, you know, mm-hmm. or the drop. The heel drop. There's an adaptation in your legs to have to, if you go to minimal shoes. And I know a lot of people have, you know,
they walk around and start running
and then they come back and say, no, these hurt my legs.
No, so, but the shoes don't hurt people. You know, runners hurt themselves. Shoes don't cause injuries, and shoes don't heal people. You know, people figure out their own issues. But I own a shoe store, so I've learned a lot just from customers. You know, we opened a store here 10 years ago selling only natural footwear. We don't sell any. We don't have Nike brands or, you know, elevated heel things.
So how many brands of natural footwear are there? I mean, well, or I mean, how many do you carry?
Gosh, when we opened, you know, 10 years ago, it was a very small niche, right? There was, I mean, the Five Fingers were there. A company called Vivo Barefoot was coming out. They make some really nice dress shoes, by the way.
Yes.
You know, could go like, you know, go to your kid's wedding and, you know, tuck shoes. But no, Vivo Barefoot. And they were also making some athletic shoes. Newton Running was there, and their platform was natural running, you know, running form. Saucony had a shoe called the Kinvara, which had about 4 mil drop. It was still a little too narrow in the forefoot. But none of these, Ultra was a concept at the time. They hadn't come out yet. Topo, which is Tony Post, another big company in the natural footwear space. So he came over from Vibram. Merrell had started coming out then, and the Merrell, like a lot of, we still have a lot of fans of like the original Merrell trail glove and roll glove. That shoe was out. Few sandal companies were being born. So Zero Shoes was born as a sandal company.
Yes.
Steven Sashin, and now he's got a beautiful line of shoes. A company called Lems was coming out. It's more of a lifestyle shoe. Now, you know, companies like On from Switzerland, they're low drop. And they fit nicely in that space, a little more cushioned. You know, I'm just kind of like thinking of going around the wall in my store, you know.
Yeah.
Was coming in. So yeah, so
There's a lot of choices.
There's a lot of choices now. Yeah.
Well, and then I know that Hoka just released a their version of Speed Goats with a wider forefoot. You know, the wide.
Yeah.
You know,
so Hoka shoes can fit perfectly in that space. At least some of the newer generation ones, because they have like 4 millimeter drop. You know, wide toe box, super light, super flexible.
Yeah, the Hokas that I had were not. That was before they had the wide toe box, and they cramped the forefoot. And
yeah, it's not good. As is, like if you're trail running, unless you're just a beautifully coordinated athletic trail runner, you know, to put those super high stack height shoes on people who don't run perfectly, they blow them apart, and they can roll their ankles so easily. So I was never recommending those. You know, certainly off road for like, you know, Jim Walmsley, for example, you know, he almost broke the 100K world record.
And yeah, I know.
Run on trails, you know, it's like, it's phenomenal. He's like Bodie Miller, you know, skiing analogy, Laird Hamilton or someone on the surf.
Yeah.
But so he can dance in those shoes and he just bounced. So for him to wear the shoe, he perfect balance, you know. But to throw that same shoe on somebody else, you know, caution.
Yes. Well, and I know some of my friends who I ran with, they ran in Speed Goats, and she was new. The shoes were new for her. And she said, yeah, I trip in these a lot more than any other the shoes that she had before. So,
yeah, you got to feel the ground a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, mix it up, you know, so people are going to find. You know, it's like the Goldilocks thing. You know, what my favorite thing is, isn't necessarily somebody else's.
Yeah. Well, and it depends on the terrain too. I mean, you were talking about running on rocks and you said you chose something with a little bit more cushion to it. And, you know, I have found that as well. I started out with the Zero DIY Huarache style sandals that were 4 millimeters thick. And that was my first, I mean, I went from Speed Goat high stack into the sandals.
Oh, I do sandals in the wintertime with some Gingy socks, and I love them in the winter. You know, wool and Gingy socks, and some sandals. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed that. I did some experimenting. Snow on the wool socks tends to stick to the bottom, and so my toes ended up being elevated because I had this layer of ice underneath them.
I have an old pair of Vibram. They used to make one that was like a neoprene. It was like a really thick snow. Five Finger, you don't make it anymore. It's called like the Launcher or something, but it's my snow one, and I love it.
Yeah,
it's got some good grip on it.
Well, I can run barefoot if the snow is not very deep and if the air temperature is warm enough. I'll use my sandals. But the ice does not bother my feet as much, and I don't go for a very long run. But I can get out and run. But yes, in snow, shoes are preferred.
Yeah. And for those listening, if they live in an icy or snowy place and they like the natural footwear. So a perfect shoe for winter is, it's Ultra makes a spike, like a track spike called the Golden Spike.
Okay, so, they are permanent spikes in it?
Yeah.
It's not the DIY that you screw in.
No. So this is like a track spike. So it's got five metal spikes, like a spike.
Track.
But it's most track spikes that high school kids wear, you know, thin toe boxes and your feet. So these are like the ultimate ice and snowshoe because you actually have, you know, metal spikes.
Mm-hmm.
I have some shoes that I put before they came out, I would put these studs, like these sheet metal screws in the bottom of a couple pair, you know, just the metal, you know, sticking on the ice.
There was a local race here that we had the volunteers. It was run every February, and depending on the terrain, depending on the conditions, several of us would show up with drills and a whole bunch of screws. And anybody who wanted to, we would put screws in their shoes before they went out to run the course.
It's great. Yeah,
yeah, it works well.
It does.
Yeah, yeah, man. And I know you can buy. They're a little bit more shaped, a little bit more aggressive, a little bit more consistently than just sheet metal screws. I've seen like inserts you can screw in, or they're studs, but they don't. I can't remember the name of it. So
I think there's even things now like go on the internet. Like old school, you were just MacGyver it,
right?
You just figure it out. Now now someone wants to make money off of that 10 cents worth of sheet metal.
Yeah, these were actually manufactured for screwing into the bottom of your shoes, and with sheet metal screws, you have just the head of the screw on the bottom, and these actually had something more like a spike. I can't remember the brand. Of course, I get all kinds of running stuff in my Facebook feed, and it was probably something that came up there. But talking a little bit about your book, you're kind of looking toward helping runners to be able to be active all their life. So what is that something that you do in your practice as well? And you're treating runners all the time.
Humans. Most of them they might want to run.
They might want to run.
The people I see in my clinical practice, you know, are fighting diabetes, obesity, heart disease.
And
walk, do something. But the main approach with those folks is nutritional approaches.
Okay.
For your brain, but they need to fix their metabolisms.
So you said you kind of go with a higher fat, low carb diet. Is that something that you have you've experimented with yourself and something you recommend?
I lived that myself because I was diagnosed with a type of diabetes in 2012.
Okay.
Type of low insulin state. So on the spectrum of what they called maturity onset diabetes of youth. So not making sufficient insulin, nearly type 1 diabetic.
Oh, wow. So, okay.
I was having A1Cs in the pre-diabetic range, looking like this, right? Looking like winning marathons, you know?
Uh-huh,
like,
right.
I just like come off of, you know, one Air Force marathon. Then I was on base, you know, go get your physical. And you know, you've got an A1C in the sixes, which is, for anyone medical out there, knows that that's not a good thing. But I was a curiosity to them then because I didn't fit the mold of a type 2 diabetic who has central obesity. That person is insulin resistant, so their pancreas is churning out more and more insulin to try to store the carbohydrates. Mine wasn't making enough.
Okay.
But the end result is, if either of us had a bagel, you know, our sugar shot up like a rocket ship. So, you know, I wore a continuous glucose monitor as a short kind of experiment just to understand what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that showed me, wow, I cannot eat the runner's diet. But, you know, going back, there were a lot of signs that I was becoming diabetic without knowing what it was. I was waking up every morning at 2 a.m. needing to eat like another large bowl of cereal because my sugars would go up and then they would crash. But I didn't put two and two together. I just thought, well, maybe it's just because I'm running a lot and I need more calories. Yeah, so I just turned the food pyramid upside down immediately in 2012, meaning, you know, all sugars, grains, flours, pastas, pastries. You know, it was eggs, meats, and vegetables. And, it, you know, this is a glucose monitor right now. And, you know, I had a 3-egg omelet this morning. And you can kind of see it's pretty flat line. You know, and had a couple hard-boiled eggs on a salad at lunch. You know, so it does not mess with my sugar. But if I had, you know, a traditional Western diet, you know, not even carbo-loading runners, 60% carbs, it'd be a disaster. But every patient I see who has type 2 diabetes, you know, if they were to adopt, that means they cannot tolerate carbohydrates. Their bodies don't process them. So if they learn how to do it correctly, the simple solution is get rid of the carbohydrates, because that's what their body cannot tolerate. Even a lot of people running 5Ks and marathons, right? You look at them, anyone who's got a belly there, maybe they're suffering through that marathon, that person probably could benefit from a low carb diet, because that's part of the metabolic syndrome, is that visceral fat, which is driven by insulin resistance. So we explain this simply to people, give them some simple tools. Certainly anyone who's fully diabetic, they can make that go away, which most people don't understand, is they can make that go away. Right? Maybe
they, by the way they eat.
Yeah, yeah. Like, okay, they got out of shape, right? Like, we're all runners, right? So then in their 40s and 50s, they got out of shape, right? They ate wrong and their body's metabolism started shifting, hormonal changes. But let's get you back in shape, right? So you just do the exact opposite of everything that got you to where you were. You know, we have people, you know, drop their hemoglobin A1Cs from double digits, you know, which are average sugars in the 300-400s, to become non-diabetes patients. Meaning they're well people, not on any medication. That should be the expectation. You know, it takes discipline for people to do this. Our society doesn't support it because you know, everywhere you go is loaded with advertising.
Well, there is sugar in everything. I mean, it's cheap. And we have friends we travel with, and she was the first one. She's diabetic. She developed diabetes and found the low carb diet. And so when we travel, she asks about all the food, how much sugar is in it, where, you know, and she's just very, very conscious of it. And she's been able to, she's been able to get off some of the medications and it was, I don't know, one medication was going to really cause some serious side effects for her.
Everything's a trade-off, right?
Right. And so she was able to just keep
getting rid of that.
But she's, and so that was actually, I adopted a form of what she did, was how I was able to lose weight back in 2017, was cut out the sugar and just, you know, cut back on the carbs and is eating more fats and proteins and vegetables.
Yeah, how do you feel?
I feel good. Yeah, I feel great.
At least 100 miles. Yeah. You can't do that off carbohydrates.
Well, and when I run long, I will eat carbs. I'll have whole foods, potatoes. Yeah. I don't even take Tailwind, you know, or for electrolytes, I use salt. You know, that's what
you're with me. Yeah, you got to have the electrolytes for those long runs.
Yeah,
you don't need the calories. You need the electrolytes, for
right?
Sure.
Right, and so I actually will take salt and put on the back of my hand and lick it off, because I found that the taste buds actually prepare my body for what's coming. And rather than, I had salt tabs, and those are real easy to like mess up how much you take.
The Comrades, kind of funny thing, you know, that now they have aid stations, but the original aid stations for Comrades of the South African run, and they still have all this stuff now. Now they just added some goos and things. But the volunteer is there with a carton of salt, right? The lady with the umbrella and some potatoes. And they're just pouring salt, like straight up salt, like massive amounts onto the, so, you know, people putting salt on their hands, like you said. So, you know, just like you'd be handed a Gatorade cup, you know, they're just pouring salt.
Yeah. And I found that the salty taste, I mean, I can monitor if the salt, if it tastes like it tastes good, I know that, you know, that I need it. If my body's like, well, no, you know, I can kind of gauge where my body is at by the way I react to the salt on my tongue. So it's been, it's been helpful.
Experiment with it. I have a little free, handbook. I have a couple chapters in my book, but if you go to, tinyurl.com/low-carb-any-budget, with a grant, we produced a little handbook that anyone could download and read.
Wow. Okay. So, okay.
tinyurl.com/low-carb-any-budget.
Low-carb-any-budget. Okay. Okay. When I do this as a podcast, I'll put that in the notes. So people can find it. So that's good.
Just try it. That's all you can do.
Yeah. And that makes
people options.
Yeah. And I know I have found it makes a big difference. And, they just find that I feel so much better. So when you run long, how do you feel? You said you fueled.
Well, if I'm going out, if I'm running anything less than 3 hours, just salt, right? Just, you know, I use UCAN Hydrate, which are these little electrolyte straws, you know, I'll tuck them in, mix it with water. But, you know, like the 100-miler, I would eat a little food at every aid station, like you say, like just a little food. And I kind of figured out about what I ate. And then my watch told me how many calories I burned.
Right.
You know, so I think I think they said like over 100 miles and burned like 16 or 17,000 calories. I put it on my blog for that run. You know, I probably took 1,000 calories over the 30 hours-ish. Mm-hmm. You know, just you got to put something in your stomach, but there's no way just the thought of eating, if you're running on sugar, if your body didn't have the capacity to burn its own fat, and that's a hormonal switch. Can you imagine running 100 miles and having to eat 16,000 calories?
That would, yes.
It's a no-go. It's just nauseated, well, and you know?
For a lot of ultra runners, even the elite ultra runners, the diet, you know, being able to take food is a big thing.
That's one less obstacle. You know, people say my stomach went, right? They trained for 6 months and they say my stomach went. So I knew going into this 100-miler that whatever was going to take me out of this race, it wasn't going to be my stomach went, because I don't need food. So
That's right.
I could screw up my electrolytes, you know, that's just guesswork. I think just, you know, always have salt with your water and pray that it all works out and that your kidneys are smart enough to figure it out, which they are for the most part.
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Your kidneys will get rid of too much. You're more worrisome taking too little than too much. If you take a little too much, you know, if you err on the side of too much, your kidneys will sort that out. If you don't take enough, that's when you get into trouble.
Okay. You're talking about the electrolytes.
Yeah. Too little electrolyte, too much free water. You can develop hyponatremia, you know, which is a dangerous condition.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know we're running kind of on, you've got a hard break that you need to get to. So about 5 minutes. So, wanted to ask you just, I've enjoyed this. And one of the things I always try to ask is what do you have planned coming up? Do you have any races or do you have any dream races? I mean, you've done the Comrades. Do you have another race that was like, wow, I'd really like to be able to go run that one?
I think, you know, the term race, I think, is very soft now.
Well, yeah.
They're kind of events, you know.
they are events.
They don't even need to be, but, you know, I'm looking, I'm 54, and, you know, I'm okay, maybe when I'm getting closer to retirement, you know, I'd love to go to Europe and just start connecting huts, you know, go with a friend or two, you know, with a little fast pack.
Oh, yes.
Just, you know, and just do some really long adventure, you know, hut running, you know, where you end up at some nice French chalet and the dude there's got the wine and the cheese and the meal. So you don't have to like do all that.
Right. And there's
and
not,
I don't want to do 50 miles a day to get there. You know, so maybe like tag some 30-mile days, you know, just walk and run, you know, just with what I have on my back and end up at the next hut with a credit card. But just that's,
there aren't very many options for that in the United States. I don't think
I lived in Colorado. So there's the ski huts, which are wonderful, and the yurts and the San Juans and, you know, so that those are pretty well stocked, you know, with firewood. You got to bring your own food, but at least all the heating supplies and such. But no, there's some, you can do it in the States, you know, you make your own adventure there, but it's not quite as the hut systems.
The hut system is probably as Europe. Take a little bit more advanced planning. So,
yeah, better chefs.
Yes, that's true. Well, if someone would like to touch base with you, get some information. Where's the best place to get?
Yeah, I mean, my book. I have a website for my book, which has a lot of videos on a lot of exercises. Uh-huh. It's called runforyourlifebook.com. You can just go there.
Okay.
Another website I run is called naturalrunningcenter.com.
Okay.
You know, I put blogs up there, and I have my own website, which links to a lot of things. It's called drmarksdesk.com, and that'll Dr. link Mark's to our races and some of the community initiatives we're doing here. So, you know,
we didn't get to talk about your race directing at all, but that's
and we got a good team here. It's all volunteer crew. Cool. And races are
Where are you located? And
I'm in West Virginia. So our race is called Freedom's Run. So you can just put that in your search engine. We are hoping we can do a half marathon this spring. and we have a full half marathon 10K and 5K in the fall. The date's going to be October 16th. So it's going to be a busy fall schedule of races, I think, with everyone. Every race is being rescheduled. I saw yesterday Boston's October 11th now.
Oh, yeah. They're pushing things back. Yeah.
So our little race, if you want to socially distance, come to our race in West Virginia.
So what
social distance by nature.
What's the name of the town and the name and your store?
Shepherdstown, West Virginia.
Shepherdstown, West
Virginia. TwoRiversTreads.com.
Okay.
Two Rivers Treads.
Okay.
Yeah, if you need some minimal shoes, my staff there does Zoom fittings. Yeah, so that's probably the.
Oh, wow. So you do Zoom fittings and you can ship the shoes.
Yeah. Support that's small good. Business. It really has been a tough year for, you know, if you have a local store out there that's struggling.
Yes.
Trying to keep their people employed.
Yeah. One of our locally owned stores here in Kansas City is a big metro area, and they still had to close down. So
Yeah. We're hanging in there, you know,
Well, that's good.
Applying for every incentive loan we can.
Yes. I know how that goes. You know, so that works. Thank you a lot, Mark. I appreciate you taking the time to chat. And I usually have a couple of weeks. Yeah, maybe we can do round two sometime. Usually I'm a couple weeks out before we get the podcast drops. And so I'll send you something when it comes out. Thanks a lot. Have a great day. Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Trail Talk. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a 5-star rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe. That way you won't miss out on any new episodes. If you'd like to contact me, you can find me on Facebook as @UltramarathonMindset, or you can find me on the web at theultramarathonmindset.com. Remember, your mindset is the key to success in running and in life, and developing a strong mindset is a skill you can improve. Hey, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time.